Since my goal this morning is to leave us with more hope than despair when talking about climate change, that was perfect. Good morning. Welcome to Prairie Unitarian Universalist Society. My name is Sandy Ingham. I am Prairie's part-time minister. I do the services on some Sundays, but not every Sunday. Sometimes people from within the congregation do the service, and sometimes people from outside do the service. So my point in all that is, if you are visiting or if you are thinking about joining us more permanently, or both, try to come to more than one service because they are very different. Prairie is an open-minded, open-hearted congregation. You are welcome here no matter your ethnic or religious background, no matter your color, your gender, your sexual orientation, your family structure, the color of your hair, your abilities or disabilities, you are welcome here, we hope. We try on this journey of life. I am hoping to leave you so excited about Climate Justice Week during this service, either that or I'm going to leave you asleep, but in the periods when you're awake, I'm hoping that many of you might want to explore this subject further with me. I'm going to be offering a discussion group based on the Unitarian Universalist Association's Common Read for 2018-19, and that Common Read book is Justice on Earth. So let me know if you're interested in having a discussion group. I haven't set a time, a month, or anything. Since I think it's December, maybe we should go for January, I don't know. But at any rate, please talk to me. Yeah. The opening words are these, by Unitarian Universalist Minister William Murray. These are the days that have been given to us. Let us rejoice and be glad in them. These are the days of our lives. Let us live them well in love and service. These are the days of mystery and wonder. Let us cherish and celebrate them in gratitude together. These are the days that have been given to us. Let us make of them stories worth telling to those who come after us. Tony, would you please light the chalice? This flame glows as light glows in the darkness. This flame dances as growing things dance upon the green earth. This flame flickers as life flickers for a precious while in each of us. This flame is warm as the companionship of family and friends is warm. Thanks. I would like to share this reading from Unitarian Universalist Minister David Blanchard. It's titled Summer's End. In spite of the 90 degree days, all signs point to summer's end. The last fling of summer will arrive with Labor Day picnics and excursions, with the packing up at cottages, with final swims in the lake, or last days at the beach. Each of us will find something to savor when the temperature is closer to 9 degrees than 90. But even before the last stand of summer, the shape of the season has already begun to change. Emily Dickinson wrote, "How softly summer shuts without the creaking of a door." Of the sounds that summer brings to the world, Blanchard says, I always think of the sound of a screen door slapping shut as one of the ways that summer announces its presence. It's a sound that Emily Dickinson would have heard, a sound that most of us grew up hearing, yet one that my daughter Emily may not come to associate with summer. Screen doors today slide or close gently, thanks to modern technology. Summer does not end with such sharpness, but with a subtlety that we might barely notice. Even now, leaves have begun to drop from trees, green and brittle. Gardens are about ready to give up. Sunflowers slouch as if they'd like to lie down and rest a while. And of course, the light is changing. The shadows come earlier and stretch out longer across the lawns. We humans begin our short migration indoors. It happens. It's already begun. Before it's really over, I hope to listen for the slapping of a few screen doors that will remind me that summer still reigns, but also to be still enough to sense the end of this time we call summer, and to know just how softly summer shuts. Pilgrims, we march along, singing our joyous song, it says, in that first hymn we sang this morning. I love that image. Why? Because we are today's pilgrims, right? Pilgrim, according to the dictionary, one who journeys in foreign lands. Aren't we all journeying in a foreign land? We call it life. Or more accurately, life in the postmodern world or life in the 21st century. Whatever we call it, however we describe the times we live in, we are all, each and every one of us, on a pilgrimage. Pilgrimage, the course of life on earth. Great definition. If we are thoughtful, rational, caring people, and I believe that we are, this pilgrimage of ours at this present point in history, 2018, often seems ominous, fraught with humongous, complex problems. We live at a terrifying moment in time, I believe. That is not to say there have not been other terrifying times in the history of the human race. But recognizing that this is a terrifying time can take us into a place of despair, of wondering why we humans seem unable to figure out how to get along with each other instead of having developed so many ways to destroy ourselves in any number of ways, one of which is the rampant burning of fossil fuels. The last two or three times when I have spoken about climate change over the past few months, I have tried to emphasize the need for systemic change. I questioned the value of what I call cosmetic change, recycling, hybrid cars, reusing bags, different light bulbs. It's a pretty long list. These things are not really only cosmetic changes, but by themselves, they won't work. These efforts have to be done in tandem with changing our basic systems at the same time. Hence, systemic change. Now, on those previous Sundays, I fear that I left you in too much despair. I know I left me in too much despair. Well, I am sorry about that. At the same time, I believe that naming our despair and frustration is a necessary step in getting answers to the question, other than what? Now, that this is not an original thought with me, of mine. Many, many people have been saying this for many, many years, that we have to name our despair and our frustration. But this morning, I want to share with you some of what I have learned about getting to the other side of despair. Of course, I'm a summer person, so I don't know if I could repeat any of this in January. We'll see. The second quote at the top of your order of service was written by science writer David Quammen. He is the author of Song of the Dodo. He writes, "To despair of the entire situation," he's referring to climate change, global warming, however we want to phrase it, "to despair of the entire situation is another reasonable alternative. But the unsatisfactory thing about despair, for me, is that besides being fruitless, it's far less exciting than hope, however slim." I'm going for hope this morning. In the summer of 2016, Unitarian Universalist lay leader Pamela Spahr was asked to teach a class called Creating a Climate of Justice for 1 week. And as I said, in the summer, Spahr has done a lot of climate justice education work with young people and adults. She was also instrumental in the Green Sanctuary program that we have implemented here at Prairie. But this particular class that she was asked to teach was being held in Washington State along the ocean. And she said to those who asked her to teach this class, "My challenge was to talk about one of the most pressing moral issues of our day in a way that inspired and moved the adults to action rather than reinforce whatever paralysis and despair they might be experiencing. How was I going to keep an audience past day one when everyone could easily vote with their feet and go outdoors to enjoy the gorgeous Pacific Northwest surroundings?" It's a challenge. I don't have to list all or any of the scary facts about what we are doing to Mother Earth. You know most of them. We have become numb to the statistics, I think. So I'll try not to repeat too much of what you already know. However, I can't ignore, I can't not mention what has been happening right here in our own community this past week. Record rains and flooding. How strange to see sandbags appearing all over the place, outside my favorite coffee shop, and to have to pay attention to which streets are closed because of flooding. This particular kind of scary weather-related stuff doesn't happen here, right? I mean, there's the occasional tornado, I get that, and then there's that whole winter thing, but record rains and flooding? Humor is almost always a useful tool when considering intense, complicated subjects. When you're in the midst of doomsday scenarios, it's good to find a good cartoon or two. I found this New Yorker cartoon recently. There's a demonstrator against burning fossil fuels entering hell, you know, with the pitchforks and the devils and all, and the protester, the activist, has his sign with him. And one of the devils with horns and his pitchfork says, "As an additional torment, our fire and brimstone are fueled by coal." Whatever can't happen. My research and reflection on this subject of what's on the other side of despair, especially around climate change, began, as all such things should, with educating myself. And I started with some reading about a debate currently taking place among geologists and other scientists. Do we have any geologists in the room at the moment? Good. It's really hard to summarize in a little tiny bit all this that I read. Here's the debate. Whether or not to officially declare that we have entered a new geological period. Its name is the, I'm going to butcher this, Anthropocene. Some of you may have heard about this, but the two sources I mainly drew from are from 2016. Time goes so fast. This would follow the current geological epoch that we're in, which is, begins with an H, Holocene, H-O-L-O-C-E-N-E, which has been 12,000 years, this is a quote, of stable climate since the last ice age, during which all human civilization developed, according to an August 2016 article in the British newspaper The Guardian. They don't spell civilization the same way we do, and the computer did not like that. What is the Anthropocene? The World Economic Forum defines it as a new present-day epoch in which scientists say we have significantly altered the Earth through human activity. These changes include global warming, habitat loss, changes in the chemical composition of the atmosphere, oceans, and soil, and animal extinctions. You might think that this is pretty obvious, the fact that human activity is the dominant influence on climate and on the environment, but it's not official yet. The scientists who want to make it official make the convincing argument that this epoch began in the 1940s or 1950s, mainly because of the atomic bomb and the building of nuclear weapons and nuclear power plants. But there are all sorts of other evidence, like all the plastic in the oceans. In his book, The Unnatural World, The Race to Remake Civilization in Earth's Newest Age, this was published in 2016, journalist David, and I don't know how, I'm going to butcher his last name, Biello, B-I-E-L-L-O, Biello. It's a good book, but it's tough reading. He makes a strong case for declaring that the Earth has indeed entered a new geological epoch. But why should we care? Well, we should care because of the conclusions that both Biello and Damian Carrington, the author of that Guardian article, reached and others have reached. Surprisingly, or at least to me surprisingly, these conclusions from the geologists and scientists aren't your usual doomsday conclusions. Their conclusions revolve around this question: what is the proper place of the human in the cosmos? By naming something to describe what has really become reality, you give it more credence. More people might pay attention to what is happening to planet Earth if we're more honest about the role of humans in nature. We might begin to have more honest discussions on the subject of what is the proper place of the human in the cosmos. There are some great quotes about why this will help humanity pay more attention to what's really going on. This one by British astronomer Martin Rees says, if we can acknowledge the threats that exist, humans could navigate these threats, achieve a sustainable future, and inaugurate eras of post-human evolution. Post-human evolution, even more marvelous than what's led to us. Well, you might argue that maybe it's not so marvelous that evolution has led to us, but I'm intrigued by post-human evolution. The best quote, though, and the best reason I found from these scientists to admit that Earth is no longer in the Holocene era, but in its brand new era, the place is on what that means for the place of humans is what Nobel Prize winner Paul Crutzen said in 2011. This name change stresses the enormity of humanity's responsibility as stewards of the Earth. I turn now to the humble straw, seems to be getting me into all sorts of trouble. I first encountered the straw problem last fall in, of all places, Grand Canyon Village. There's a corporation called Xanterra, which has the rights, it's the concessionaire for the Grand Canyon and Phantom Ranch at the bottom and other national parks. They like to portray themselves as being environmentally aware. And I worked for them briefly. They do a better job than most corporations, maybe, sort of. So I'm sitting at a restaurant having breakfast right on the rim of the Grand Canyon, and one of my favorite servers comes to wait on me. I had worked with her, so I still know her from years ago. She had a big button on with a straw and one of those lines through it. And she didn't have any straws, you know, how they all have straws in their aprons. So I asked for one, and she goes, we're not using straws, no more straws. And I thought, oh, come on, are you kidding me? I have sensitive front teeth. I can't believe now that I was actually offended. Eventually, I was able to say to myself, waste, think about waste. And I don't remember the statistics, but it's huge. It's unbelievable. And also, apparently, there's a straw that's okay to use now. And again, I can't remember. I suppose it would be
a paper.
Oh, good. Maybe we'll be able to do this again.
Yeah.
I can't believe I did that. Because it usually doesn't work anymore. It wasn't supposed to work. All right, this may sound trivial and frivolous, but it's just an example of how we're so ingrained in our habits and what we do. I don't use a straw at home to drink my ice water. Okay. What are our options? How resilient, how accommodating are we willing to be to bring about real change? What are the options other than despair and fear and hopelessness and numbness and so on and so forth? Well, they range from the trivial and the mundane, it's the straw example, to the global, to that interdependent web of which we are all a part. And I like to think that our theology, because yes, Unitarians and Universalists have theology, that we have perhaps a leg up on part of the world, because we believe in the interdependent web, that seventh principle. And I am a seventh principle preacher, basically. Here's what I found on the other side of despair. There is so much going on, positive things, all over the world, right now. Conversations, seminars, experiments. Two things that I find so encouraging, and you might not see them as signs of hope. One, the expression of despair and fear and grief about global warming and climate change and Mother Earth. As I said, you have to express things. Is that Mother Earth? You have to express the pain and the grief and the frustration. You have to name the pain before we can move on. Remember that wonderful James Baldwin quote? Not everything that is faced can be changed, but nothing can be changed until it is faced. And the second strange thing that made me hopeful is the admission by experts and non-experts that we don't necessarily know what we are doing or where we are going every time someone comes up with a new thought or a new idea, a new action to stop climate change. Examples, attempts to farm the ocean floor or colonize, that's the only word I can think of, outer space, planets in outer space. Freezing, Bilo talks about freezing carbon dioxide in rocks, I think, or maybe in the ice cap, but the ice caps don't, that's not going to work since they're melting. Unitarian Universalist minister Adam Robersmith compares our situation to that of our Universalist ancestors in the 1800s. At that time, fear was an important part of most Christian congregations. You know, the fire and brimstone approach to ethical living, the hellfire and damnation theology, the idea that if you aren't a good person, you were most likely going to spend eternity in hell. And yet, well, Robersmith says you would think sin and vice would have vanished from the American experience. But no, they're still around. Hosea Ballou, one of our best known Universalist ministers from this period of time, wrote, now get this title, this is from the early, maybe mid-1800s, Examination of the Doctrine of Future Retribution. Ballou writes, the preaching of future rewards and punishments is not only useless, but pernicious. All such preaching, be it ever so well intended, not only amounts to a declaration that God and moral virtue are in themselves unlovely and unworthy of being loved, but as far as it is believed, serves to alienate the affections from these most precious objects. In other words, God, moral virtue, the universe, the good things, the sacred things in life, anything that we might consider to be sacred, they have no value in and of themselves unless we humans are somehow rewarded or punished by how strictly we believe in them. Well, there's not much room there for error, human or otherwise. Robert Smith sees an analogy here, as do I, to our present-day attitude towards the earth. Is the world worth saving only because we fear ending up in hell forever if we don't cherish the earth? Well, that doesn't really work with Unitarian Universalists. But Robert Smith makes the case that humans haven't adequately grasped the fact that nature, the environment, is intrinsically valued in and of itself. Mother Earth needs a better publicist. It's valuable not because we can make money from it, not because we can dig out gas, oil, mineral deposits, not because tourists are willing to pay to visit whatever wilderness areas are left, but because it is Earth. It's valuable in and of itself, and we're out of right relationship to it, most of us. We do call this place home, you know. This earth place, we have to get back into right relationship with earth because it is the right thing to do, not because we're afraid of some future punishment. Although there would be a future punishment. It would be the ultimate punishment if we destroy the earth. How do we motivate people to do the right thing for the right reasons? How do we move adults to action? Well, as I said, usually not by threats of hellfire and damnation, especially for people of our beliefs. But here is what I found on the other side of despair. Here are some answers to that question I posed earlier about other than what? What systems do we want to live under? Of course, the seventh principle. Everything is connected. All that exists is in relationship to everything. With everything. I know this. I know this in my gut and in my heart. I know this. But somewhere along the line, especially over the last year and a half, I lost this knowledge because I was in despair. So how wonderful to come back to that and remember that, that it's all connected. On the other side of despair is the growing awareness of the relatively recent concept of intersectionality, which is another way of saying everything's connected. It's a little more complex than that. But it means that rather than staying in our silos, we need to leave them. Now, I first ran across the use of the word silo this way at General Assembly. And what? Why don't they just say comfort zones? But I kind of like silos. I'm getting used to that. So we have to get out of our silo. Our silo might be immigration rights. Our silo might be healthcare. Our silo might be environment. It can be any number of things, but everybody has to get out of their silos and work together. Because if you work on one oppression, you are working on all oppressions. We're just beginning to understand this, that all oppressions intersect with each other. If you work on one injustice in the world, you're working on all of them. On the other side of despair, I am discovering more and more chatter about systemic change. I hear debates about resilience, about accommodation, and these are good debates. On the other side of despair, I rediscovered the importance of storytelling. Because our stories and those of the people who live before us give us answers to the question about other than what? What should we do other than burn all the fossil fuels? And of course, the Aborigines people, the Native American peoples, they get this. Many of them have gotten this over the ages. Stories worth telling will help those who come after us know how humans shaped the earth and what they did eons ago to preserve and cherish our earthly home. And with this story, about an Aboriginal band of people known as the, I'm really going to butcher this. So if we have any native peoples here from Australia, please forgive me. This particular band of people are known as the Ngarrindjeri. They have a story about an ancient ancestor named Ngarrindjeri, and it goes like this. Ngarrindjeri had many wives, and yet he was not satisfied, chasing them continually from morning to night. Fed up, the wives fled, hightailing it across fertile plains to what is now Kangaroo Island in the middle of broad, shallow Melbourne Bay. But Ngarrindjeri's wives got there by foot over dry land. Ngarrindjeri knew of their treachery and knew where they had fled, so he angrily raised the seas and flooded the plains. He turned these wives into rocks that just barely made it above the tide line between Kangaroo Island and what is now the mainland. Based on the water level today, this story is of a time at least 10,000 years ago. Now, this isn't a unique story, unique to the native peoples of Australia. There are tales like this all over the world that try to explain the rising sea levels during the last ice age. Many, the Klamath of Oregon here in this country have a similar tale, only it's about Mount Mazama and its crater lake. The key to preserving such tales seems to be a cultural focus on truth. Not unlike, Belio says, the stories told by science today. Humanity is constructed through such storytelling. So on the other side of despair, I found, rediscovered storytelling, history as story. Robersmith says that simply presenting information is not enough. Scaring people with doomsday scenarios does not produce sufficient change. In fact, it often creates resistance. Well, that's not where we want our energies to be, in resisting the information that's out there that we can use. That kind of resistance takes a lot of energy. I say let's resist despair and all of its tendrils, fear, anxiety, sloth, depression. In Robersmith's words, we have the ability to learn and grow and change our cultural norms. In other words, we have options. And when we fall into the despair, I think we forget this. We forget the options. Sophia Betancourt, some of you will know that name. She is a professor at Star King School for the Ministry, but she's also on the Unitarian Universalist Board of Trustees, and she was one of the three interim presidents we had. Has that been a year ago already? Mm-hmm. Sophia Betancourt. I went to a lecture at General Assembly that she was giving about climate change and despair. And she astounded me when she said that she feared humanity had already crossed the threshold. They'd already gone over the tipping point, that we can't solve this problem of climate change before it's too late. Well, I agree with that, but then the very next thing she said is more important. And I also agree with this. She said, I can't live in that space. I can't be in that place for very long. And I certainly agree with that. The future is not yet determined. And I have to remind myself of that all the time. I have a tendency to think in absolutes where the future is concerned. Belio writes, the biggest solutions are not even technologies. Think about that. The biggest solutions are not even technologies. They are education, they're storytelling, they're books. Belio says books remain one of the best technologies for changing minds. Intrigued by intersectionality as the basis for social justice work and understanding the necessity of stepping out of my individual silo, I stumbled upon this wonderful quote by, I think his first name's Bill, Plotkin. I call this a duh quote. Duh, slap yourself upside the head quote. A viable plan for transforming our culture will not come from the worldview of the values that produced it.
Duh.
A viable plan for transforming our culture will not come from the worldview of the values that produced it. I think that you have a pretty good definition of systemic change. What we mean by systemic change, right there. Where to find the will? Well, all over the place. Remember when it seemed as if everybody smoked? We found the will to change that. Although, it seems to be in movies again. But anyway, recall that women couldn't vote until relatively recently in this country. Relatively recently in the overall scheme of things. Consider that slavery is illegal in most countries of the world. Now, it's still there. It has not disappeared from the face of the earth, but it's shameful and hidden because it is wrong. Resist despair. Bilyeu says that the real battle for the future is in our minds. The future belongs to those who offer reason to hope. This is not a battle of beliefs, though beliefs matter, but of actions. If you want to look at reading number 704 in the back of a hymnal by John Murray, who was a Universalist minister in the early 1800s, you will see the line, "Give them not hell." This is the early 1800s. "Give them not hell, but hope and courage." The last verse of the first hymn. Age after age we rise, 'neath the eternal skies, into the light from the shadowed past. Still shall our pilgrim song, buoyant and brave and strong, resound while life and mountains last. The closing words are by Adam Rober Smith, slightly adapted. I couldn't decide, obviously, between the two quotes. So, Bukowski says, the human race exaggerates everything. Its heroes, its enemies, its importance. Rober Smith says, if we act out of our love for this earth, capital E, and all its inhabitants, we can avoid despair. Our Unitarian Universalist theology tells us to choose faith and hope and deep, abiding love over fear. Let us refuse to be made immobile by fear and despair, instead choosing one more faithful action in every moment. That's what you were saying. Let us remember our heritage and use that wisdom to chart a just, holy, and sustainable path forward, even though we exaggerate our importance. May it be so. Go in peace. Greet your neighbors.